Welcome to the Best of the Left podcast, with clips today from Rachel Maddow, The Young Turks, Ring of Fire, and Tom Hartman.
I pledge allegiance to the Bible, God's holy word. I will make it a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my path. I will hide its word in my heart that I might not sin against God.
Let's go to Richard in Alabama on line three. Richard, welcome to the Young Turks.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. I'd like to first say that I'm a progressive, but I profoundly disagree with you.
Okay.
With both your analysis and your stance.
All right.
Iran is an enemy of ours, and in no way, shape, or form should they be able to possess nuclear weapons. They partake of the jihadist ideology. As such, they are an active enemy of the United States. And as such, preemption is justified, up to and including
ridiculous.
Use of nuclear arms.
No, I think that's
just goddamn unconscionable.
Thank God you're not a progressive.
You're not a progressive.
Yeah.
Get the hell out of
here. Oh, yes, I am.
All right, let me explain a couple of things. First off,
No. I don't think there's anything you can explain to
me. Oh, I see. Okay, then why don't you do the show? You keep explaining what a great idea nuclear war is.
Hang on, Richard. I'll let you. You think a preemptive nuclear strike would be warranted?
Radiation spreading throughout the Middle East. Tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people killed. And you think that's a swell idea when they didn't even attack us? Just because they have some vague thing you call jihadists, that they're our enemy. So go ahead. Yes, is that a great idea?
Yes, it's a wonderful idea if that's what's necessary.
Right.
I have no love for jihadists or their ideology or the God that they serve.
Okay.
I do not lose any sleep over what happens or befalls their society, their civilization. As far as I can see, the whole Muslim history has been one of conquest and destruction and wanton cruelty.
Kind of the kind that you're advocating right now for us, right?
Yeah. I can't remember.
No.
Help me out, because Richard, and I honestly, I'm not versed in the religious history of the world. The Crusades, who picked on whom there? Help me out, because their whole history is violent, but not the Christian history. That's not violent at all, right?
Beat up on itself. But let's understand the Crusades were
defensive
measure.
It's a good point.
Yeah, they beat up on each other. I know. But help me out. Ben's on a good track here. The Inquisition.
Who was that?
That was in Spain, but that was probably the Muslims,
the
right?
The Muslim Inquisition.
Who did the Inquisition?
Is that right?
Excuse me. I'm not defending the whole entire practice of Christianity.
Oh, no, but
I'm
you're saying the Muslims are violent,
You have no love for their God, and you think they have a history.
I'm saying that when one looks objectively at their religion, at their history, at their culture, it's been one of unremitting bloodshed.
Oh, is that right? So let me ask you something. When you mentioned unremitting bloodshed, it reminded me of World War One and World War Two. Who did World War One and World War Two? It was the Muslims, right? Just help me out, Richard. Was it the Muslims?
No, that was the Europeans, and that was us, too. Yes.
Wait, that was us, too. Wait, now we've got the Crusades, we've got the Inquisition, we've got World War One, we've got World War Two. Wait. Let's just finish the thought here. What else? The slavery trade. That must have been the Muslims. That must have been the Muslims, right? Who did the slavery trade, Richard?
Let me educate you.
Because you've been doing a great job of educating us so far, Richard. Go ahead, Mr. Progressive.
Perhaps I'm reaching those that are listening to you. But in any event, if you recall, Muhammad started the Muslim faith in Saudi Arabia. It spread from out the peninsula all through what was Christianized the Middle East, the Levant, What have you. And they went and attacked the Byzantine Empire and the Roman Empire and so forth.
That's right. And they were the only ones who's had empires back then. Because the Christians had no empires, and they never conquered anybody. They were just peace-loving people who started crusades and pogroms and witch trials and Inquisition.
You guys are missing the big argument. I mean, both you and Richard want the same thing. You don't want Iran to have nuclear weapons.
No, I was going to get back to that. No, Richard and I don't want the same thing. Richard wants to wipe the Muslims off the face of the earth. Richard is a sick, sick individual.
Hold on. So, look, I mean, as far as he's explained now, you guys want the same thing. Neither one wants Iran to have nuclear weapons, correct? Richard, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So, Richard's idea of doing it is to wipe Iran off the face of the planet.
If it comes
correct?
To that.
If it comes to that. You know, in a couple of months, if it comes to that.
So, Richard.
Yes.
Do you believe possibly using nuclear weapons at this point is a little premature, if not totally retarded?
No, I don't.
You still don't think? You still don't
think?
You still don't think there's room for discussion and diplomacy and trying to stop their weapons program?
It's time to giddy up, huh?
This is part of history. This is something that's continued.
Okay.
Muslims have not been decisively defeated. It's left to this generation now to do it.
Give you incorrect change next time you come to Starbucks and I'm working as a barista, because you'll just kill me.
Muslims haven't been decisive. Dude, aren't there more? They're the whole freaking world. What do you mean they haven't been decisively defeated? You're not going to defeat a religion that is as...
No. He's saying we can. He says just nuke them all. You know who else is jihadist, you know, or could be considered jihadist, Richard? Syria, Yemen, Oman, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan? Should we nuke all of them?
Large parts of Russia?
Should we nuke all of them, Richard?
As far as I'm concerned, Muslims as a whole, as a general construct, occupy a subordinate concern, a moral concern for me.
Subordinate moral concern. I love that.
That's right. I despise their ideology. I despise their religion.
Richard,
but you kind-hearted, Richard the kind-hearted, wants to exterminate 1.2 billion Muslims.
Let me ask
because they have a lower morals than Richard does.
Well, Richard,
God bless you, man. You just topped Adolf Hitler.
No,
congratulations.
I wasn't even going to go that far, but
Richard, the argument of whether how to deal with Iran is an interesting debate for people, but you just proclaimed yourself a bigot. There's no other way around it. That's the only way. The only thing a reasonable person could conclude from what you just said. Unfortunately, I was ready to have some more fun with you, but
no, we're done.
Yeah, but I'm done.
Yeah, Richard the kind-hearted with the subordinate moral values or whatever the hell he's got is willing to kill 1.2 billion. But you know what, Richard? It makes sense because you brought up a history of violence in some religion. I forget which religion you said, but that religion did a Holocaust, didn't they? Where they tried to wipe out a whole nother religion. Oh, wait a minute. That's right. That wasn't Islam. That was also Christianity. You know,
Richard, I'm sure everything will be okay just as long as we wipe them off the face of the planet, but preserve the infrastructure and oil. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, you've got to keep their oil. That's very important.
Conservatives love to beat up on the IRS. It's damn near impossible to carry on a conversation with a true knee-jerk neocon and not have to listen to them tell you how evil the Internal Revenue Service is. But just stay tuned this year and watch how all the right-wing windbags really focus the attack on the IRS, because the IRS is defying Karl Rove. They're defying George Bush, and they're even defying our Republican Congress in their effort to investigate fraud abuses of 501c3 nonprofit organizations. When I first looked at this story, I suspected that the IRS had a Republican political agenda in the way that they were targeting 501c3 groups. I was wrong. In fact, I found that the IRS may be one of the most important vehicles for saving religion and preserving democracy. They've begun to seriously draw the line on the mixture of politics and religion by revoking the tax-exempt status of churches and religious organizations that are pushing church money, church facilities, and church manpower into the world of politics. You see, in the year 2006, it looks to me like the IRS is the only government entity that's noticed that churches don't pay taxes because they have a special tax exemption, and that churches are rubbing that tax exemption in the faces of every tax-paying American by completely ignoring all the rules and all the limitations. They're ignoring the fact that that tax-free money is a gift from the American public. In order to collect billions of dollars and not pay taxes on that money, the rules are very simple. Anybody can understand them. First, as a church or religious organization, don't endorse political candidates or political positions. Second, don't distribute voters' guides at all. A religious group can't recommend their favorite slate of political candidates or their favorite political party positions. A preacher can't endorse a particular candidate specifically or implicitly from the pew, or in fact in any capacity as a church leader. And it should be more than obvious that a church can't mobilize its staff or its congregation in an effort to promote a political candidate or a political party. It's just good common sense. It's very easy stuff to understand, especially if a church wants to collect huge amounts of money and then pay no income taxes at all. It's easy to understand. But in Pennsylvania, Rick Santorum and about 150 clergy members don't seem capable of playing by the rules in that tax exemption that the IRS has laid out so plainly for all Americans. This month, those Pennsylvania pastors have already laid their 501c3 tax exemptions on the line by posting a website notice called the Pennsylvania Pastors Network, where that church-based organization wants to hire 10 full-time political organizers to help churches mount a get-out-and-vote campaign. No surprises about what they want their congregation to vote for, because those clergy are joined at the hip with a neocon advocacy group that calls itself Let Freedom Ring, that's been for years hustling religious groups into becoming more Republican. It doesn't take a trained theologian or a trained bottom-feeding politico like Rick Santorum to follow the money on this one and to understand that this is all about politics, pure and simple. And that's just fine if those clergy want to make the mistake of moving from preaching the Word of God to preaching the Word of Karl Rove. But it's also fine with most Americans if every one of those clergy and every one of those churches involved in that abuse of the law loses their tax-exempt status, pure and simple. Just think of how much money American taxpayers could put back into an American treasury that's going so bankrupt that we're approaching a $9 trillion debt record. It's the largest in the history of civilization. We could take a portion of all that tax-exempt money and use it to fund Social Security, bring American education into the 21st century, pay for health care for all Americans, improve America's social services, pay for government research into life-threatening diseases, and eliminate poverty in America. Every one of us should be grateful that the IRS had enough courage to revoke the tax-exempt status of Pat Robertson's Christian Broadcasting cash cow in the mid-80s when he crossed the line, and Jerry Falwell's old-time Gospel Hour PAC when it became evident to all of us that all this tax-exempt money was just being laundered into pure and simple Republican politics. Several months ago, progressives were upset that a minister at a Pasadena, California church made a political speech about the war in Iraq, and the IRS began an investigation about the church's 501c3 status. As hard as it may be to stomach, the truth is that the IRS did exactly what they're required to do to protect the interest of all American taxpayers. In America today, churches and other religious groups own about 25% of all the land in the U.S. The assets of the Roman Catholic Church alone exceed the holdings of America's five largest corporations combined. The average American family pays more than $1,000 every year to make up for revenue lost to churches and religious groups because of tax exemptions. And most of us aren't bothered by that because it's easy to see how organized religion is taking up the slack for a Republican government that's abandoned charity and decency in the way that government treats the least of our society. But at the same time, a growing majority of Americans draw the line where it comes to their church playing politics with their money. And if 150 churches in Pennsylvania want to use taxpayer money to elect Rick Santorum, the numbers show that most Americans wouldn't even blink if the IRS did exactly what we've given them the authority to do, and that is to revoke their tax exemptions and draw a clear line between religion and politics. A line that even Rick Santorum and bottom feeders just like him can't cross.
The PAP Attack on Air America Radio Network. Go to ringoffireradio.com or airamericaradio.com for more info.
Your faith was strong, but you needed proof. You saw her bathing on the roof. Her beauty and the moonlight overthrew you. And she tied you to her kitchen chair. And she broke your throne and she cut your hair. And from your lips she drew the hallelujah.
Now it's time to talk about one of the scariest films that I have seen in a long time. And one of the best documentaries I've ever seen. It's called Jesus Camp. It's a documentary about a religious camp in Devil's Lake, North Dakota. And it's for kids. Kids often as young as 5 or 6, they go there to get saved, to accept the Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior, but also to get really drilled by these evangelical children's ministers, adults who minister to children, to minister these kids about their devotion to God. When you watch the film, the reason that it's scary is because this seems less like camp and more like a way that kids are being brainwashed, really young kids in a lot of cases. The camp's pastor is named Becky Fisher, and she's one of the central characters in the film. She is one of the reasons that the film is so disturbing. Pastor Becky Fisher says that Muslims raise their children to be willing to die for Islam, and she would like to do the same for American Christian children.
They're going into the schools. You go into Palestine, and I can take you to some websites that will absolutely shake you to your foundations and show you photographs of where they're taking their kids to camps like we take our kids to Bible camps, and they're putting hand grenades in their hands. They're teaching them how to put on bomb belts. They're teaching them how to use rifles. They're teaching them how to use machine guns. It's no wonder with that kind of intense training and discipling that those young people are ready to kill themselves for the cause of Islam. I want to see young people who are as committed to the cause of Jesus Christ as the young people are to the cause of Islam. I want to see them as radically laying down their lives for the gospel as they are over in Pakistan and in Israel and Palestine and all those different places, you know, because we have, excuse me, but we have the truth.
Trying to build an army of Christian suicide bombers among children in America. Joining to talk to me now about Jesus Camp is one of my favorite people in America, Mike Papantonio. He hosts Ring of Fire with Bobby Kennedy Jr. here on Air America Radio on the weekends, one of the best known and most successful trial lawyers in the country. And now in this new film, Jesus Camp, Mike Papantonio stars basically as himself. He stars as the voice of reason in the film. Mike Papantonio, thank you for joining us.
Good to hear from you again. Yeah.
Now, how did you end up getting hooked up with this Jesus Camp documentary?
Well, there are a lot of people listening to Air America. I mean, that's the best way I can describe it. A lot of people are tuning into Air America, and these directors, they followed the Ring of Fire. So Bobby Kennedy and I did a couple of shows on kind of the mean-spirited movement that's taking place in the evangelical movement and how it's affecting politics and religion, and they picked up on that.
I have to say it is one of the best documentaries I've ever seen in my life, but we should talk about what the Jesus Camp idea is. It's basically a camp that's sort of a Bible camp. It's more of an evangelism and right-wing religious right politics camp for kids that's run by a pastor named Becky Fisher.
Well, right. I mean, it's not really about just religion. What's happening is that religion and politics have become so close that now what I call the political evangelicals, they feel comfortable having a special setting to teach their children not just about religion, but about politics. It's not the word of Matthew. It's not the word of Jesus anymore. It's the word of Karl Rove and George Bush. Mm. And so these kids are hearing this at 4 and 5 years old. It's nothing short of brainwashing.
Well, you know, and Mike, when you talk about indoctrination, that's really what it seems like. I mean, the film is viscerally scary because they use the idea of being born again, of being saved, and recognizing Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior. They use that to say, well, that can happen to kids as young as 4 and 5 years old. So at 4 and 5 and 6 and 7 years old, we want to put these kids in an environment where they can pray for the president. They can learn about anti-abortion politics and tactics. They can learn about the evils of the liberal culture that they need to be at war with. They can start to conceive of themselves as warriors and then basically set about to lead a fight against their own country. Yes. It's really, it's an army.
Well, that's the kind of language they use. You may recall in the movie where they're dressed up in camouflage and hitting sticks together with face paint.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a spooky, spooky scene. You don't grow a church. You don't grow a religion by bombing abortion clinics and murdering women clinic doctors or ostracizing everybody who's different or cozying up to rich and powerful. You don't grow a church by being a warmonger. And so all of these things, though, are happening in the evangelical political setting. And there's something going on here, obviously, more than just religion. It's not about the word of God. It's about the word of George Bush. It's a Republican, mean-spirited message that's being drilled in these kids' heads.
It is very political, and it's very extreme. But, Mike, I wanted to ask you about how much of the scary stuff that you hear in this film and the scary stuff you hear, particularly coming out of these children's ministers' mouths, how much of it is rhetoric and how much of it is to be taken at face value? I mean, we played a clip at the opening of this segment here in which you heard the pastor saying that they wanted children to be prepared to die for Jesus the way that suicide bombers are prepared to die for Islam. I mean, they're using some of the most extreme rhetoric I can imagine. How much of it do you think just is rhetoric, and how much do you think of it should be taken at face value and seen that?
Well, I think when you're talking to a 5 or 6 year old, you have to take all of it seriously. You could call it rhetoric, yeah. I mean, it can be. You could say, well, this is all just symbolic language. But when you're dressing a child up in camouflage and you're painting their face and you have them dancing around with sticks, there's something more to that message. It's affecting and it's shaping these kids. And these kids, you understand, these kids, they're preparing to be America's leaders. They want them to be on the school boards. They want them to be senators, congressmen, the president if they can. These kids, this is all they know. These kids have never even been to public schools. They're taught that the theory of Darwin is the work of the devil. They're taught from the time they can think that the founding fathers told us that if you take God out of politics, that America will be destroyed. This is all they know. They don't have the ability, they never developed the ability to think for themselves, and it is a very scary thing. I got to tell you something. I looked at, there's a scene in that movie, the last part, where I'm taking off my headphones and I'm dazed. I'm literally dazed because I just interviewed the woman who runs that camp, and I'm just thinking, I feel like I was talking to an alien.
She said in that interview with you, she says to you in the film that democracy is set up to destroy itself because democracy requires that you give everyone equal rights and therefore an equal freedom, and therefore democracy will be destroyed on the earth and the Lord will be the true king.
Yes. It's an apocalyptic vision of the world, don't you see? They have to fulfill this prophecy. And when you talk to them about it, they are completely, they're waiting for that rapture when they look to the right and they look to the left and they're gone, but those people, those sinners are still standing there. They're waiting for that day, and they believe that George Bush, they honestly believe, Rachel, I'm not exaggerating this one bit. They honestly believe that George Bush has been anointed to take them to that day. That's why it doesn't make any difference whether we invade Iraq or Iran. It doesn't make any difference whether we proliferate a nuclear war over there. It's supposed to happen. I have a very strong Christian background. I'm not down on Christianity. This is an abomination of Christianity. And the problem is, Rachel, at the end of the day, what happens when you mix politics and religion is if politics does well, then the religion does well. If the politics drops off the face of the earth, so does religion. You can't tie the two together because everything has its day. And if you mix those two, both of them are at risk, politics and religion.
Mike Papantonio, you're one of my favorite people in the entire world. Thank you so much for joining us. I miss you, Mike. It'd be good to see you when you're back up
here. Oh, I can't wait.
Mike Papantonio hosts Ring of Fire with Bobby Kennedy Jr. here on Air America Radio on the weekends. He also stars as himself, as basically the voice of reason in a new alarming documentary called Jesus Camp. It's playing at the Regal Theater here in New York City. You can get tickets at the box office if you haven't gotten them online. It's getting a lot of attention, and kudos at the Tribeca Film Festival. We've put a link to the film so you can learn more about it, even if you're not here in New York, in case it is coming to your town, so you can also see clips from it online. We've put a link to the film website at our site, which is mattoonline.com.
What's really going on below, but now you never show that to me, do you? But remember when I moved in you, and the holy dove was moving too, and every breath we drew is hallelujah.
Kevin Phillips is with us. Kevin Phillips. I have to say, Kevin Phillips, welcome to the program.
Happy to be here.
I just have to say, you are one of the most brilliant commentators of the American scene, bar none. I mean, I first became involved in politics in 1964 at the age of 13, going door-to-door for Barry Goldwater. And when your book came out in 69, by that time, my politics had flipped 180 degrees, and I was rather distressed by the emerging Republican majority. You now seem to have made a transition, as it were. Your new book, American Theocracy, The Parallel and Politics of Radical Religion, Oil, and Borrowed Money in the 21st Century. If it's okay with you, I'd like to try to, in the short time we have, touch on each one of these three.
Sure.
And I want to just say to my listeners, and we don't do a lot of author interviews on this program, and although I do, you know, a monthly one for BuzzFlash, but this is a book that every person listening to this program, Republican, Democratic, non-political, whatever, should be reading. This, you have written one of the most important books of this, certainly of this decade. You note in your book the reason for highlighting history's relative handful of covenanting cultures is the biblical attitudes their people invariably share: religious intensity, insecure history, and willingness to sign up with the Old Testament God of war for protection. And then you note, Israelis, and to an extent scripture-reading Americans, are on their way to being the last peoples of the covenant. Two questions. Number one, can you elaborate on that? What does that mean? What does that mean for America and for the future of the world? And wouldn't you throw Islam into that category?
Well, the covenant is essentially something that's, I think, a Christian conception. Whether you could put Islam in and borrow that same concept, or whether it's something related, I wouldn't try to say theologically. But what's happened over the years, Jews and then Protestants, Catholics basically didn't do this too much, have picked up on this. And you've had covenanting peoples in Holland, in Scotland, in the United States, the Puritans when they came. In some ways, the Mormons think of themselves this way. Elsewhere, you've had them in Northern Ireland, ferocious covenanting there. But it hasn't lasted in the last 20 or 30 years as things have changed in Northern Ireland. And you had them in South Africa, the Afrikaners, the Boers. And that, too, is pretty much dissolved. So that's why I say that the people of the covenant, the Christians of the covenant, are principally in the United States. And then you have the Jews of the covenant in Israel.
But it's more than just of the covenant. It's of a particular worldview, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, if you're a...
Which becomes a political worldview.
Right. It's an embattled people who believe that their tribulations qualify them as having been singled out and having a covenant with God. And generally, the whole history that breeds this attitude, it usually takes a couple of centuries to really set in. The people who have this attitude are very biblical, a sense of very embattled. They generally claim territory, or they relate to territory. It's just hard to describe it in a way that doesn't sound archaic, and in a sense it is archaic because of its biblical origins.
Kevin Phillips, author of American Theocracy. In the next hour of this program, I'll be discussing, debating, whatever, Rick Scarborough, who's published a book called Liberalism Kills Children. his proposal, his thesis, and that of many of these folks, is that Christianity is under assault. As a Christian myself, I find that rather ironic. Christians are certainly the majority in the United States. I'm wondering if your sense of it, certainly it seems to be, actually you build a very strong case for it in this book, perhaps you can expand for our listeners, that without that ultra-hyped, continuously hyped sense of persecution, a lot of these guys wouldn't have the power that they have, they wouldn't have the platform that they have, and they wouldn't have the followers they have.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And in the case of the South, the reasons why the Southerners are, in a sense, covenanters within the United States is the role of the Civil War in the interpretation that the South survived the Civil War. It stuck to its churches. Its churches regarded themselves as embattled. The Southern Baptists would not rejoin with the Northern Baptists. And they expanded. They expanded to fill in the old Confederacy. They expanded in the border states. They expanded westward. And now there are almost 20 million members of the Southern Baptist Convention, and that's as many as you get in all the mainline Protestant denominations combined. And it's a pretty militant culture in terms of its beliefs and its biblical fidelity, and they claim that George Bush is just as biblically faithful as they are.
And in large part, what sustains their tenacity and ferocity is their sense of being under siege.
Yes, their sense of being a regional people, a separate identity that they have and that they wouldn't give up after the Civil War, and that this has made them strong, but it always makes them, in a way, persecuted. And, of course, the Covenanters of all varieties have always felt this persecution, and that's part of what makes them tick.
They have to maintain it. Thus, the war on Christmas and the war on Christianity and all the stuff that they're hyping over at Fox News and whatnot.
Yes, but in fairness to them, I think if you go back in the 60s and 70s, there was an attempt on the part of liberals and seculars to push churches and religion further out of the public square. Mm-hmm. And we live in Connecticut near a little town, fittingly called Bethlehem, where they have a Christmas celebration, Christmas manger scene. It was really under attack. Now it's gone so far the other way that you have a traffic jam at Christmas time.
Mm-hmm. Now, to move to debt, and the economy in general, you talk about the German, the Japanese, the Swiss exports, the role of America relative to the rest of the world. You note, for example, the Germans, the Japanese, and the Swiss, in terms of production and exports and on a per capita basis. You say the Germans, the Japanese, and the Swiss do this with workforce wages and benefits and industrial production costs as high or higher than those in the United States. Yet they are net creditor nations. We've become the world's largest debtor. They enjoy strong current account surpluses. We have the largest current account deficit in the world, I believe. And they have citizens who have achieved relatively high savings rates. What do they know that we don't know? What are they doing that we're not doing?
Well, one of the things they do is that they maintain a sort of national sense as well as an international sense. They're people that believe in their countries as something special economically and culturally. And they also have very, very successful export machines and focuses. They produce top-quality products, and they export them. And they do this because they pay a lot of attention to quality in a way that, in many ways, the United States has sort of forgotten about. If we buy something for $39, you know it's never worth repairing it. You throw it out when it starts to malfunction. The other thing they haven't done is they haven't become financialized countries. In the United States, moving money around now constitutes a larger share of the GDP than manufacturing does. It's really a striking upheaval. Financial services are 21% of GDP, and manufacturing's down to 14%. It was reversed in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, that's the major shift that you document in your book, and I thought it was, you know, very, very well done. The hawking of America, massive U.S. international debt, is the product of domestic overconsumption. We have less than a minute left, Kevin Phillips. Are we facing a Great Depression? Have these guys sold us out?
I think we're facing a major and painful readjustment. involving everything from oil to the excesses of debt and the probability that the dollar is overvalued at the present time. I think we face a wrenching readjustment probably in the next decade.
What can and should Americans do about that?
Start discussing it. Start forcing the politicians to pay attention. They don't want to confront all this. It's difficult. It would offend their contributors, so they'd rather just be like ostriches.
We've been living off essentially a credit card for decades now.
Certainly for the last 15 years, and it's got out of control after 9/11.
For the average person, what will be the consequence of this?
For the average person who doesn't have a lot of capital skills and education, they're going to be hard-pressed to maintain what they've got now.
Kevin Phillips, the book American Theocracy, The Peril and Politics of Radical Religion, Oil, and Borrowed Money in the 21st Century. Buy this book and read it. Kevin Phillips, thanks so much for being here.
Nice to talk to you.
All right, guys. Now on to the lovely story of the resurrection.
So
apparently, it happened in the Philippines. I didn't know that.
So Dominic Diamond, he's a British broadcaster, and he went to the Philippines because he wanted to be crucified. Most people go to the Philippines for the ladyboys.
I believe that's Thailand. I think they go to the Philippines just for the really bad food and this. And the women, just
yeah,
the women.
Underage hookers.
Oh, it's but no, the ladyboys are there in the Philippines too.
Oh, they are.
I'm
oh,
not.
Okay.
Don't get me wrong. I'm not knocking Thailand.
I'm not well versed, but
no,
I hear you.
The Philippines is a beautiful country, and I actually grew up knowing a tremendous number of Filipinos. There was a lot of yelling. That's basically what I sensed.
Why did you know a lot of Filipinos?
My best friend's housekeeper was Filipino, and she lived there, and she had the whole domain over the downstairs of the house, and she would bring all her little Filipino friends over all the time, and they are tiny.
Yeah,
they are.
They are
tiny little people. And they would go downstairs and at all hours of the night and yell at each other. You should open the door, you'd be like, because it was the basement, and so you'd, and it was a fully furnished, nice basement, but the basement door would be closed, you'd open the door, and you'd hear, bah! It was great. It was fantastic.
Okay, let me ask you a couple questions, Ben. Your friends kept Filipinos in the basement?
Yeah, pretty much.
Fascinating. And number two, is there any chance that was just that particular family and not the whole race of Filipinos?
I don't know. I never thought about it like that.
Oh, I see. Okay.
No, so here's and I'll do this, and you may want to turn down your radio.
Have you noticed though when you listen to a group of other people speaking in different languages, though it always seems like they're yelling?
No, these people were yelling. Don't give everybody. That's a good point. But these guys. No. They were. And her name was Isabel, and she. I must have had 150 meals in my life with her. But anyway, so I would go over to Dan's house. I would call Dan on the phone, right? And she would answer.
He's your friend with the Filipinos in the basement,
right? And he would and his single mother, and she worked like 70 hours a week. So they needed to live in help just to feed the kids and take care.
They needed a whole Filipino family in the basement.
And so we would call up, and she would answer the phone. You know, hello. And I would say, hello, Isabel, is Ben, can I talk to Dan?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then she would then proceed to go, Dan, get the phone! And every time, and I'd be like, where could he be? Where could he be? You have to yell that much. Can you please go get him? Can you start to go up the stairs? But Dan, get the phone!
Okay. Now, I had a lot of different friends from a lot of different races, growing up. And see, I'd call my friend Tuan Nguyen, is Vietnamese, of course. Hmm. And his grandmother would pick up the phone and say, Tuan not home. That meant Tuan not home.
Oh.
Okay. Then I'd call Cindy, and her grandmother would pick up the phone. Cindy's Chinese. And the grandmother would say, wah.
Wah?
Yeah, wah.
Really?
I never understood. To this day, we never understood what it meant. Once we made fun of Cindy because of her grandmother, and she cried. It was a bad day. It was not a good idea. But it's funny. I mean, Jill's right in a lot of ways. Foreign languages sound foreign.
They sound so foreign, yeah. But then it was great because they would literally, it would be like a little Manila downstairs. And I mean, you come over, there'd be 35 people. They have great time.
Did they ever crucify anybody down there?
There was no crucifixion. You know what they did? They played poker.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah,
who doesn't love the Filipinos?
Yeah, who doesn't love the Filipinos?
By the way, there's some Filipino women that are gorgeous.
All right, so this guy, Dominic Diamond, British broadcaster, he's a radio and TV presenter, and he's an outspoken a Daily Star columnist, it says here. He goes down a Good Friday for a television program, right? And what he was going to do, as you might imagine, as I inferred on Good Friday, was he was going to get himself crucified.
You mean like they're going to tie his hands around the cross and stuff and put up the cross, and he's going to sit there for a half an hour or something and then come back down?
Nope. Diamond was set to join an elite group of radical Roman Catholics who mark each Easter by reenacting the crucifixion. Thousands of people gather to watch the volunteers nailed to crosses with metal spikes the size of pencils.
Ow!
Yeah. Well, so Dominic Diamond...
That is such a bad idea.
He was going to do it for Channel 5, television Channel 5 in England.
Sure.
Dominic Diamond, though, when it became his turn to do this, he'd been negotiating it for some time, right? And he wanted to go on the pilgrimage, taking in the Vatican and a Jesuit retreat in Italy, culminating in the crucifixion to restore his faith in God, right?
What do you mean negotiating? Like, can you guys do maybe just do one hand and one foot? What do you mean negotiating?
Did I say negotiation?
Yeah.
I think maybe I said meant to say crucifixion.
Okay, that's all right. So he's planning to do this for a while, and he finally gathers up the courage, and he's down there.
Right, and he's down there, and he goes through, and part of it is, he says, at no point, he says, at all times in the journey, I've been guided by my God in ways I could never have predicted, having experienced the humility of bearing my own cross through the streets. So he went through the streets, they carry their crosses just like Jesus, and then they get crucified. But at the moment that it was his turn to get crucified, he wasn't first, he said, what happened was he broke down and wept after watching nine Filipinos take their turns.
Just like Jesus did.
They also get whipped.
You know, Jesus did that too.
Yeah, Jesus broke down and cried. And he said then that God wanted me only to pray at the foot of my cross.
Oh, did God change his mind at the last second?
Yeah. So,
did he?
So he sunk to his knees.
I wonder why he did that.
He sunk to his knees and started to pray, sobbing, and said God only wanted me to pray at the foot of the cross as local people and tourists started to boo.
Oh, that's awesome. All right, so let's understand what happened here. Let me break it down real quick for the people who didn't get it. Guy goes to get nailed on the cross. They're going to put the actual spikes through his hands and his feet. He sees the nine Filipinos do it, and they're not playing. The Filipinos aren't. Yeah, I mean, they're yelling, but they're not playing.
Do they have to insert the people they get crucified with the sword in the side as well? Because that happened too.
Oh, really? No, I don't
think so. Yeah, they were crucified with the nails in the hands and then the feet, and then to make sure that that Jesus was really dead, they stuck a sword in him.
I don't know.
A spear, I believe, yeah.
Whatever.
And then that's why he bleeds from the side, etc. Now, I've heard of this Filipino ritual before.
By the way, it's called Carabrio.
Of course it is.
Or Carabrio.
So romantic.
In fact, we went to Passion of the Christ, and right before I was talking to the person sitting next to me, because I definitely want to know what kind of people go to Passion of the Christ. You know, you're going to run into some crazies.
And it was
a Filipino woman, and she was kind of young, and we started talking about this, and she kept saying before the movie, you know, this is real. This is the truth. This is history. I'm like, I got it. Let's just watch the movie, right? And she's like, no. This is history. I'm like, I got it.
First documentary, God.
And then she started telling me about her brother who does this thing. Okay.
Carabrio.
And every year he does it. Every year he's got the things, the holes in his hand.
It's interesting.
His feet.
There's an interview here with a guy who did it. He's done it for 7 straight years. Maybe it's the brother.
And then, but they do other things. Like Ben's right. They like lash themselves with a whip sometimes, or they have other people do it. They walk on glass. It's like a whole carnival of freaks,
They wear the crown of thorns?
Yes, they do, and apparently that's really painful.
Really?
Yeah, it's a crown of thorns.
I suppose, but yeah. I would have figured that would be the least painful out of all the different things happening.
No, they don't find just like rose thorns. They're like thorns.
And they scrunch it down on your head. They're not playing.
And all the stories I've read about this, and we've done stories about this in the past, I never see, like, what do they do afterwards? I mean, they need medical treatment.
Oh, yeah, they get medical treatment.
I mean, but they need antibiotics, and they've been stabbed through the hands with a nail.
I don't really think that's really going through the crucifixion, as you should be, if you have to get medical treatment afterwards. I mean, if you really want to do it up like Jesus did, die.
Well, then
God will really dig you.
Yeah, but then you have to get resurrected.
And that's kind of a pain in the ass.
Yeah, I promise that won't happen.
All right, so this guy goes down there, and he's going to do this whole thing. He sees the people do it, and then all of a sudden, he starts weeping like a little bitch. I'm sorry, now we're going to have the bitch coalition against us.
I think we should give him a pat on the back. I mean, he got his marbles back. I mean, I think we should be laughing at the people that actually get nailed to the cross. I mean, the fact that this guy knelt down and started weeping... I mean, Good job, buddy. You finally figured out you're crazy, and you tried to resurrect yourself.
No, no. Let me just tell my favorite part of the story, is that the last-minute revelation.
Yeah, it's not just that he chickened out.
No, he didn't chicken out, Jill. He didn't come to his senses.
God chickened out.
No, God told him at the last second, man, that's going to be really painful, right? So he's like, oh, well, God, what did you say, God? Oh, thank God. Okay, God says I shouldn't do
God
it.
God only wants me to pray. He doesn't want me to get nailed to the cross. Now, here's the negotiations part. Excuse me. Negotiations had taken place to bestow on Diamond the privilege of becoming only the second Westerner ever to take part in this event. It's held in the town of Katood, and here you go, Cenk. Men dress in white robes and flagellate themselves with glass-tipped paddles and bamboo whips.
That's what I was thinking, not walking on glass.
The glass-tipped pedals, and they whip themselves in penitence for their sins. Now, it was going to be a documentary. Producers say the documentary will still be aired. Let me just hit you with a couple people who did this.
We got to get a hold of that documentary.
Sebastian Horsley, he's an oil painter. He was the first Westerner to take part in it. He said it would be valuable for him to experience that level of pain for artistic rather than religious reasons. He's not even that religious.
Uh-huh.
He just wanted to do it because he thought it'd be cool. And he says that it's not a surprise, and he's glad that this guy backed out of it because he thinks that doing it for a documentary, he goes, I'm glad he bottled it. I mean, going over there with a Channel 5 crew is not right. It got leaked to the press when I did it, but I wouldn't allow any film crews to come with me. So he was hardcore. He was authentic.
Because if you're this level of crazy, you know, you should really carry it all the way. You don't want to exploit your insanity. You just want to kind of enjoy it in your own peace and private after they carry you away to the hospital.
Let me hit you then with the guy who might be the brother of your friend at the movie. Ruben Anaja. He's a Filipino carpenter, takes part in the festival every year. He became Diamond's mentor as the presenter tried to summon the willpower to be crucified, willpower that ultimately did not exist. Mr. Anaja has had himself nailed to a cross every year since 1988.
How fun.
18 straight years to show his gratitude for God for saving him when he fell out of a window.
You know...
Oh, no, wait. Everybody enjoy that. Okay. Oh, thank you, God. You saved me from that terrible injury. So every year, let me get another terrible injury. Are you sure he's a Filipino carpenter and not a Jewish carpenter?
You know what these people aren't getting is that Jesus did all this so we wouldn't have to do it.
They're
missing
awesome
the big point of Jesus' big moment. And I think it's sad because they're taking away from how special it is what Jesus did by reenacting it and taking away his glory. Jesus did this so we wouldn't have to.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Now, going to the break, let me add one little thing.
I think I'm a better Christian than they are.
Yeah.
Well, when we come back from the break, I want to hit you with what the executive producer said, and just an indication that this Dominic Diamond character is obviously, well, not that we need any substantiation, he a crazy person.
Right. By the way, Jesus didn't do this for us. Jesus thought he was the Son of God and that he was going to get rescued. That's why he cried out on the cross, God, why have you forsaken me? And God apparently was unmoved, and he died, and nothing ever happened other than that. Just, you know, a little side note so you understand actual history.
You know, yeah, I was going to say, that's history. That's history.
The devil goes after the young. Those who cannot fend for themselves. That's why we're trying to help you. We're trying to warn you. And while I'm on the subject, let me say something about Harry Potter. Warlocks are enemies of God. And I don't care what kind of hero they are. They're an enemy of God. And had it been in the Old Testament, Harry Potter would have been put to death. You don't make heroes out of warlocks.
This is Ben Mankiewicz from the Young Turks. If you'd like to podcast the entire Young Turks show, please go to our website at www.theyoungturks.com for more information. You can also support the show by becoming a TYT member or by purchasing Young Turks merchandise.
Thanks for listening, everybody. I've said it before and I'll say it again. We live in a world full of crazy people and we're the minority. We've got to stick together, though, and that's my awkward segue of the day to ask you to go vote for me on Podcast Alley. I can just feel that top 10 within my grasp. If you don't think that a podcast is capable of jumping from number 300 to number 10 in just 1 month, well, I tell you, it's doable. If I can get every single one of you to go vote right now, I could do it. You got to do it now, though, because if we wait till the end of the month, I don't even have enough listeners to match the number of votes that the top podcasts get. So you better get on that real quick. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a good one.